All right, we'll call a meeting to order. At least unofficially we'll call it to order until we get a quorum, but we can still take testimony, which is our work for today. And I want to welcome you all. We'll do the commercial interruption a little later on when a few more members get here about what's going to happen next week and the updates. But we have three or four good testifiers here tonight. I think two are together. And to cover some more of the input the committee's taking, and I've been very pleased with the substance and the quality of what we've gotten so far, and I think that, we've had a chance to air some ideas that haven't been aired quite as widely as they might have been in the past. So I'm very pleased about that. So our first testifier is Dr. Nichols of the Nurses Association. And do you have any, were there handouts with your presentation? Do we have those? Are they coming? Okay. So we'll give you a chance to go through for a few minutes on what you have to say. And if we get going too long, we'll tell you it's time to stop. And please tell us what's on your mind, Doctor.
Well, Chairman Abler, members of the committee, first I'm going to have to ask for a little accommodation. I let the docs have a whack at my head here a few years ago, and I'm a little hard of hearing. So when you're speaking, please speak up so I can hear you well.
Okay, welcome, Dr. Nichols.
Thank you.
If you go too long, we'll tell you very loudly to stop. But okay. You've got a few minutes to make your thoughts known, and we appreciate that. So,
Chairman Abler, members of the Healthcare Cost Containment Division Committee, my name is Dr. Dan Nichols, RN. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to speak on behalf of my professional organization, the Minnesota Nurses Association, where I currently chair MNA's Task Force on Healthcare Reform. And we're also discussing many of the same issues as this committee. Registered nurses represent the largest group of healthcare workers in the country and the state, with about approximately 2.5 million in the U.S., 65,000 in Minnesota, of which 17,000 are MNA members. We work in all sectors of healthcare, ranging from primary care clinics to physicians' offices, community and public health programs, hospitals, long-term care, home health care, all the way to the end-of-life services such as hospices. With this comprehensive workforce, nurses possess valuable insights into the problems of the healthcare industry as well as some of the solutions. A single overarching problem with the healthcare industry today is its 39-year history of unabated excessive healthcare cost inflation. It's not been a single year since 1965 that the cost of healthcare has not risen two or three times, and occasionally four times the rate of economy-wide inflation. We started trying to remedy this problem in 1970, and those first efforts failed, and several have failed subsequently. Past initiatives reform failed for one fundamental reason, and this is what we believe. The proposals on the table today for federal and state initiatives will probably fail for the same reason, and that is that each attempt at health care reform is focused on only part of the health care industry, leaving the remainder of the industry to drive up health care costs. Today's healthcare industry can be characterized as a large conglomeration of jigsaw puzzles, none of which fit together well. In some cases, I'm not even sure they come from the same puzzle. We're faced with an industry that has complex components that encompass different healthcare delivery mechanisms, such as primary care, hospital care, long-term care, public health, and many more. A myriad of pharmaceutical and medical supply businesses, and a mixture of public and private payer mechanisms that vary in complexity and agendas depending on who the customer may be and what state they live in at the time. For healthcare reform to be successful in the 21st century, we must undertake a comprehensive, systematic, and complete remodeling of the industry in the United States. We need to restructure how and where healthcare is delivered, how the industry is managed and regulated, and most importantly, how healthcare is financed. We have some ideas on big picture resolutions. We have to philosophically decide which direction to go. For those that might favor the free market enterprise model, we must break the monopolistic grip that modern medical paradigm has on access, delivery, and payment of healthcare systems. This model is predicated on an outdated acute care episodic approach to healthcare services. It relies on diagnosis and rapid short-term treatment of diseases with little or no attention to follow-up care or long-term management. This model no longer serves the needs of our society and today's consumers, where 8 out of 10 of the top causes of health problems are the result of chronic disease or lifestyle and environmental factors. Several major initiatives would be needed here, just to mention a few. We would need accurate and reliable information provided to consumers about services and providers. Individual consumers would need to be the primary purchasers of services and not employers and third-party payers. An open competition amongst healthcare services by all providers would be essential. And finally, most importantly, the consumer needs real choices in accessing these services. Another solution on the other side of the aisle would be that of a single-payer plan that provides consistent and universal health care to all citizens. The savings on the industry-wide administrative overhead alone of this type of plan would be immediate and substantial. Also, there would be an ability to influence health spending priorities for a focus on the kinds of care nurses think are important, and that would be health promotion, illness prevention, and long-term disease management instead of the current model of diagnosing and treating acute diseases after the fact. Some more specific cost-saving solutions that we have worked with over the years. In the past, M&A has publicly presented numerous ideas on delivering health care and funding health care in new and creative ways, many of which have research-based evidence to back them up. But here are a few concrete ideas that need to be considered. Nurses think it's essential that health insurance programs cover all citizens. The logic is compelling and has been supported by research. When consumers have access to appropriate services and have the resources to seek care early, more serious and expensive illnesses and the use of emergency and or critical care services can be avoided. Second, nurses believe there exist more than adequate financial resources within the industry to provide affordable, high-quality care to all citizens. What is required is a serious changing of priorities throughout the entire industry to shift financing to things that nurses believe to be most efficient. And again, I reiterate, that'd be health promotion, disease prevention, and effective management of chronic illness. A third idea is that to provide and support programs to make better use of community-based nursing services, and we've had some demonstrations here in Minnesota, such as the Block Nurse Program and the Evercare Program that are piloted here in the Twin Cities. The increased use of advanced practice nurses to deliver primary care and case management. The evidence is in on these nursing models. They provide effective, cost-efficient care. Consumers are satisfied with their health status, and money saved. A fourth issue that we need to look at seriously is the impending nursing shortage. That must be addressed fairly quickly. If we start today, we might see the first graduates in 3 to 5 years, or a little longer. So by 2010, the shortage, if left unattended, will be in full swing. In the 1990s, healthcare administrators railroaded in that patient-focused care models, especially in other parts of the country, laid off about 20 to 30% of their RN staff and replaced them with unlicensed assistive personnel. And if the remaining RNs were lucky, they got to work with LPNs. The quality of patient care declined and the incidence of patient problems rose. This practice wasn't prevalent in Minnesota as other parts of the country, but it was tried here. Subsequently, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, there's a developing research base that clearly demonstrates a higher mix of RNs results in reductions in patient complications and injuries related to care delivery services, improved patient outcomes, quicker recovery, and overall improved patient satisfaction with care received. So now the healthcare organizations are rebuilding their RN staffs. Throughout my entire career of 35 years, nurses have demonstrated the willingness to support healthcare reform in order to abate the healthcare cost inflation. All through the utilization review strategy of the 70s, the prospective payment techniques of the 80s, and the preferred provider managed care initiatives of the 90s, nurses have lost their jobs through layoffs, changed venue of practice from inpatient to outpatient, consistently have done more with less, foregone even inflation-pacing pay raises, and changed models of care delivery, often without our advice and consent. And yet, for more than 30 years, despite these accommodations and sacrifices, we've seen healthcare cost inflation roar back within a couple years of a major healthcare reform initiative. Needless to say, we're not impressed with the past practices of segmented, incremental healthcare reform. This is especially true when we have seen healthcare executives pocket excessive performance bonuses and perks. Physicians receive substantial production bonuses, and insurance, pharmaceutical, and medical supply companies post record-setting profits, even in economically depressed times. We're at a crossroads in healthcare cost crisis and reform, and we ask you to avoid the practices of the past and embrace a more expansive, comprehensive view of healthcare reform. We must address the remodeling of the entire industry to achieve the kind of real change that will result in getting costs under control, redirecting money to pay for health promotion, disease prevention, and managing illness to better meet the needs of our contemporary society and healthcare consumers. Nurses are committed to this goal. Indeed, one of the three prominent phrases in M&A's mission statement is to advocate for quality care that is accessible and affordable for all patients and consumers. There's plenty of money in the healthcare industry to achieve this goal, and we know it. This is no small undertaking, but it's about changing priorities and paying for what nurses value, and the savings will come. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be more than pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Nichols. Questions from the committee, or from the division, excuse me. Since we're on that jump on the talk of you here, if you didn't find a free market solution, you're open to single payer, huh? Is that right, doctor?
I would phrase it the other way around. I'd be more inclined to support a single payer system. I don't really believe there's a free market in healthcare anymore, and there hasn't been for 20 years, and that's from a consumer standpoint, because I'm old enough to be a consumer now.
Thank you. I see Gretchen Huntley is smiling at that thought over here. So, any other questions, members? I do want to thank you for coming. We've got your comments here, and they're well taken. No one has any questions. You've satisfied our need for information. So thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
Liz here? Oh, yeah. Hi. There you are. Hi. Bring your friends up there. And well, Ms. Kwan, welcome to the committee, and I know you brought a couple guests along today for us.
Yes, I do, and I'm very pleased to have them. Mr. Chair, members of the, what did you call it, division?
Healthcare Cost Containment Division.
it's good to be with you. I'm Elizabeth Kwan Burney. I'm the volunteer executive vice president of a group called AMOM, Advocates for Marketplace Options on Main Street. We are a 501c3 nonprofit coalition of employers and providers that has been providing technical assistance more out of a labor of love than anything else since 1996. In 1996, for some of you veterans who are maybe almost as old as I am, you'll remember that there was the first county based purchasing bill that Senator Samuelson offered after it had been introduced by, I don't know, like 10 times. It was one of the first times that a bill had been introduced multiple times so lots of authors could be on it. They took a do-good report that the pioneers of AMOM had written about, that we had to figure out a way for local providers and local employers to work together, that you couldn't take, even if there had been a financing system that had been reformed during Minnesota care time, we still needed to do something to make the system more efficient at the local level where the health care is delivered. Well, they took some language from that, and it caused a great stir, but it stayed in the bill until the bill was vetoed by Governor Carlson. And that was sort of the beginning of AMOM. Since then, there have been lots and lots of everyday heroes. In fact, about half of our board are still are from that time. It's a volunteer board, and they very much believe in trying to find options for both employers and providers working together. So the first thing we did was 62T community purchasing arrangements. We tried some HMO demonstration projects. Health Partners is in the room. They were game to try with us in northwestern Minnesota. We tried a stop-loss pilot project to try and get businesses of 10 or fewer employees back into the market, back into the group coverage market. And most recently, last session, thanks to Representative Abler for so kindly including Representative Huntley's and Representative Bradley's bill in his bill at the end of the session, we tweaked 62H so that it worked better with 62T and allowed small employers, including businesses of one, we hope, to an opportunity to group self-insure. Now, as all of you know, large employers can self-insure, and with that they thumb their nose at state mandates and follow federal mandates. The reason for that, the reason it was passed in the 70s, is because it's very difficult to follow mandates in 50 different states if you have employees in all of those areas. But with that has come some cost savings that has been really attractive to employers of smaller and smaller size. I would plead with you that we should be watching those smaller employers who feel that their only option is self-insuring. It's probably not the best place for them to be. They don't have other options, or they don't think that they have other options other than leaving the group market completely and giving their employees some little extra cash and saying, go to it in the individual market. As all of you hopefully also understand, the individual market does not have guaranteed issue, which means that pre-existing conditions are not covered. So you have a kid with asthma, a farm kid with asthma, and that asthma condition is probably not covered. Anyway, the group self-insurance seemed to be the way that we had to go for two groups, especially. That was the manufacturing component, just because there just didn't seem to be other available options. We had tried an accountable provider network working on the provider side, and after 9/11, there was no reinsurer who would even return our phone calls, which was very different than it had been just, you know, a week or two before. AMOM, and then the other portion of the economy which is just really hurting, is the agriculture component. And honest to goodness, the actuaries don't seem to have ag workers on their risk charts to even try and figure out the risk. So that we needed to come up with a different model for both of them. And that's what you're going to hear about today. AMOM and its technical assistants has said there can't be any funny money and no funny business with the group self-insurance, which means that we've worked with reputable groups, long-time stable groups, to try and come up with a new option. And so I've, of course, been frustrated when some of the regulatory concerns have been, well, what happens if? Because we've taken chances before for the last 20 years with HMOs and their solvency and other such things. The other thing that AMOM has insisted on is consumer cost disclosure in order to get to consumer involvement, which is where I think all of us want to be, no matter who we think ultimately should be the payer. The consumer has to know the cost of the service, and that is hidden in most instances right now. And if there is anything given out, it's charges, and charges doesn't do anything. It's what the reimbursable amount is, what is paid to the provider. That's been very difficult. Representative Bradley did some pioneering work with a few sentences last year, and there's been lots of discussion in the provider community and the health plan community on how to go further with that. The two folks that you're going to hear from are examples of what has made both our state and our nation great, and I say that with absolute and utter sincerity. Citizens who see a need and don't just sit around and talk about it and try and figure out a global solution for sometime in the future, but really act and see how they can help the people that need health care coverage now. I have with me several reports that AMOM has been a part of in the past. There's one that Jason has electronically that just came off the press yesterday from University of Minnesota Morris, and it's focused on the West Central Purchasing Alliance. I'll make those available to anybody that wants them. With that, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Jeff Nielsen.
Welcome, Mr. Nielsen.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Nielsen. I'm the General Manager and CEO of United Farmers Cooperative. It's a member-owned cooperative about an hour southwest of here. We have about 10,000 members. We also employ about 100 people in 8 different communities in south central Minnesota. My job here today is to little quickly tell you a little bit about what I think all of you already know, and that's the challenge facing agricultural producers in rural Minnesota and elsewhere. As most of you know, farmers pay three times as much for health care as us folks that are lucky enough to have regular jobs. I guess farming is their regular job. As much as twice as much as other self-employed individuals. Most agricultural producers also have self-insured or self-employed plans and don't have access to group insurance discounts and things like we have. Liz already mentioned the problem with pre-existing conditions. Liz also mentioned the HMO Purchasing Alliance that I'm aware of was started and created, but that capped it at 10% of farmers. I'm kind of a person that I'm not real good at this. I'm better on my feet. But I guess to talk, I can stand. I'm about the same height if I stand, so that's right. Basically, what I'm here to talk about is a co-op care project. We've been at this for about 3 years. I'll do my best to hit the facts, but I think the story is really what's between the lines and what we've been doing. First of all, we need to thank the legislation for some of the things that they passed last year to try and pave the way so we can get done what we're trying to get done. What this is about is three cooperatives, United Farmers Cooperative that I work with, two other cooperatives, Cannon Valley Cooperative, which serves about 10,000 members down the I-35 corridor. Oh, yeah, I got to click the button. Thanks. And then Harvestland Cooperative, which is near Redwood Falls and a large chunk of geography there. For the most part, we reach just about from east to west in the corridor south of Highway 212 across south central Minnesota. What we've been trying to do is create a way for farmers to come together and have access to purchasing health insurance, more importantly, get access to health care information. We've been attempting to form a self-insured pool, AMIWA, over the last 3 years. I think this can work because farmers, more than anybody you're ever going to meet, understand risk. I was going to get this. Okay. We really had a challenge because despite lack of interest by traditional and reinsurers, for 3 years, they look at us, are you organized, can you do this, do you know what you're doing, do you understand risk? I could tell you stories for several hours on that. But we were able to go to the USDA and get a $2 million grant to help fund the gap and the stop loss. And that's really critical. When they look at this, you know, that's obviously you're all well aware of how insurance works. I've become much more aware of it over the last couple of years. But we estimated that we need $300 to $350 per insured member to fund that initial stop loss. The stop loss fund would then be used to fund a percentage of each co-op's claims in the $30 to $100 range. In other words, to reduce the exposure that these reinsurance companies look at as saying, boy, you don't have a record, we don't have a history, you're individual farmers. And unfortunately, when you go and talk to these folks, I'm a dairy farm kid from western Wisconsin, you know, so I'm used to this, but they seem to have this notion that all the farmers, you know, they're missing fingers, they're missing limbs, they take risks. Remember, these folks are self-employed. If they don't go show up to work every morning, things don't get done. So they're as concerned about their health and well-being as anybody. And in most cases, the labor on that farm is their wife, their sons, daughters. So it's kind of silly to think they don't really care about that risk management. But unfortunately, that's kind of the scenario that gets painted. Additional stop-loss funds would be obtained through private foundation grants that we're working on, or these producer members are willing to fund it. Just give them a chance. Initially, we think we got to be pretty simple about this. We think we need to have one plan. Since most of these farmers are used to a high deductible, we probably would add an HSA component because they're used to funding that initial risk essentially on their own. Right now, we think we can come up with 2,000 initial lives with the objective of increasing to 5,000. I'm sure all of you, you know about the economic development, the challenges in rural Minnesota. I mean, if farmers leave, you know, they don't come back, we need to keep people on the farm. One of the biggest issues they leave is access to affordable health care. I got to go faster. Click the button. Got it. Waiting for the, really one of the issues we're waiting on right now, and I think after I get done here, we're going to have some folks from the Employer Association visit, is those folks have been helping pave the way. We've bumped into each other several times over the last few years. They're trying to find a way to help their small employers. I'm trying to find a way to help the people that own the company and that I work for, who mostly are employers of one or a few, depending on their corporation or their farm or how they're set up. But the EA submitted an application in September for joint self-insured plan, and they're still waiting for approval. There seems to be a bottleneck at the DOC while the EA is tripling, and these bottlenecks tripling our efforts, because now they're saying, gee, there's already a tough environment out here. We really don't know what we think about this health care plan for farmers and that type of thing. So they're already skittish. This doesn't help the situation any. So we got to take one step at a time. I'm here to help support them and also try to tell our story. We had the Commissioner of Agriculture request the Commerce to clarify farm families are considered businesses of one. Many of these family farms, and I get real skittish over that term because it brings up this American Gothic thing, and that's not really what the farmers are that I work for every day. Many of these operations are multi-million dollar operations. They have tremendous amount of assets at risk. They take risk every day. They're very sharp businessmen. I could give you statistics on that all day. These folks know what they're doing. Or they wouldn't still be in business in the environment that they're in. We think that this may require some regulatory ruling during the legislative session so that they are considered businesses of one and they are a farm business. This isn't a lifestyle issue. They happen to live on a farm and they run a farm business. I guess in closing comments, this is simply good business. This is good consumerism. We think that we can provide affordable quality health care. We think we can take control of low deductibles. We can provide fully covered preventative health care. We can stabilize the insurance rates. I'm just going to take just a quick minute if I can summarize. We know this can work. In 1999, when I took over as CEO of the company, we had about 70 employees. Only about 35 of them were insured because we had health insurance premiums that were doubling every year. It's costing those employees working at a co-op that we're a farm supply dealer. We sell fertilizer, feed, grain, LP gas, and we handle grain. So if it blows up, kills stuff, or can spill, we handle it. So our insurance rates were kind of high because, again, we had to live in that pool where people looked at what we did and looked at the inherent risk of that. Fast forward, we decided to get involved and become self-insured in 1999. We actually worked with Sheffield Olson, I think they have some people here, developed our own plan, started to fund it ourselves. Fast forward 5 years, today, we just launched into our sixth year. Every employee, every family that I'm responsible for got a $1,200 decrease in their health insurance premium this year. We're self-funded. We've got reserves in excess of $500,000 in the bank. We do preventative care. We hold clinics. We bring the spouses in. Right, wrong, or indifferent, the predominant workforce in our business is male. We bring them in, and we educate ourselves in making good choices. So the last 3 years, we either had a stabilization of our health care costs and insurance premiums. They actually went down this year. I think we can do the same thing if we give these producer co-ops an opportunity to share in the risk. It's really simple. It's a fundamental change in how we do it, not more of the same old. So, sorry for getting on my soapbox, but I've been fighting this for about 3 years. I know we can make this work. We've got the funding. We just need to help get this thing started. We don't even need the money. Well, I should never say that, should you?
No, no, no.
She just pulled on me over here. But I appreciate the opportunity to share our story. I think this is an alternative that can work. We know it can work. Appreciate the chance to come and talk.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Yeah, don't say that you need the money when the finance chair is sitting here. So that's a dangerous thing to say. He's keeping track of these comments. I'm sure there's a bunch of questions, but I have a couple. In your last comments, you're talking about the model that's working with the $1,200 rebate, et cetera. Just can you outline for me the general model that you're using there? Is this with the HSA and you have a high deductible and so on? Could you just give me the salient points of the plan you're providing?
Essentially what you're able to do when you take control of that, when we first started out, we were buying reinsurance at, I think, $12,500. So we were self-insuring up to that level through pools funded by the cooperative business, because we could do that as a business. As we grew in reserves, we were able to buy reinsurance at higher levels. So we did a combination of things. We educated ourselves, made better health care decisions, at the same time built reserves because of the self-insurance, and that now today we're buying reinsurance at $45,000. And now the reinsurers, we have our fifth of people who will sell us reinsurance because we're a very well-funded group, we're a healthy group, and we've demonstrated that responsibility. So that's how we've been able to control those health care costs.
And Ms. Nichols, how large is the group that you're talking about in this particular group?
Our employee group now has 90 families insured, I believe it is.
another question, then I'll turn it to members here. The Commerce Department is not playing ball. Is that what you're telling us?
That's what we're telling you.
And did they offer a thought as to why?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I'm sure that, you know, putting myself in their shoes, this is a different deal. This is something new. It's different. Self-funded groups have been tried before, I'm sure. I don't know the answer to that question. Probably the right one to answer that.
Ms. Combs, you want to answer now or you want to do it in private?
Mr. Chair, I suggest we wait till we have to ask it all from the Employees Association.
Okay, well, very good.
And Representative Bradley has also been in some conversations.
All right. Members have questions? Representative Broden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Mr. Nielsen? Is that right? You indicated that, I think I wrote down, educated ourselves to make better health care decisions. What did you do? How did you approach that in terms of educating your members?
A lot of things that I think we could replicate in this type of a model with the farmers. And it's the little things. As simple as every other week in our employee newsletter, we talk about making healthy choices about we've helped people stop smoking, stop drinking, lose weight. The simple things, but the farmers don't have a mechanism for this either. So we model it that way. We actually did health care clinics that I mandated employees to come. I tied it into some of the things that we have to do, like safety training and that, and we'd bring in people from the County Health Association, do blood tests, cholesterol screening, all of those type of things. And then with just the little things of, you know, I have 3 children. They get sick. That happens. But make good decisions. If they're really sick, go to the emergency room. If they're not really sick and it's a cold, don't do that because it just costs money and isn't going to change anything. Just the simple little things. I could give you all kinds of statistics of how we, real numbers of generic drugs, all those things, little things that if you're a member of a healthcare organization, they help teach you that. Farmers, they buy their healthcare or they don't have access to it, so they're not getting the educational component either. In our model, we would include that in it. Well, that answers the question.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nielsen, your comments give me hope. It sounds like there are some simple things we can do to significantly cut costs, and you are showing the effects of doing those things, so thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Nielsen, first of all, I commend you for hanging in there. Not many people would hang in as long as you have in trying to put this alliance and co-op together. You indicated that you thought that you could get about 2,000 initial lives with objective going to 5,000. Out of what kind of what's your potential pool and overall? How do you estimate how many people might get involved there?
Well, that's somewhat of a swag, but if you look at our membership numbers, we have about 30,000 members between those 3 cooperatives. But I'd also add there's a whole lot of other cooperatives in the state and surrounding states that are taking a look at this if we can get this done. We simply tried to estimate the number of lives that we could get based on a lot of statistics that are out there of who is underinsured, who don't carry health insurance at all. I think it's scary when I talk to our members and find out farmers that have the kind of asset base that they have, they don't carry health insurance because it costs them $15,000, $18,000 a year for catastrophic coverage. They roll the dice and just go without.
You did a survey of your
members. Yeah, we actually did a survey starting, I forgot, it's been so long, it was like 3 years ago, we did a survey of our members to find out how many people would be interested in this. It's been 3 years, and I can tell you that not one week has gone by when I don't get calls from our members saying, Jeff, are you going to get this done? Usually happens in December and June, which is the biggest renewal time for health care, and they get the renewal notices and their price increases, and they call. That's why I keep fighting.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up. You indicated sort of for your own 90 or so families what kind of design you did. In terms of what you're looking to put together, could you kind of outline for the division a bit about what is sort of the structure of what the plan would look like? What's it built on? I'm talking about now for the co-op alliance.
The components of the insurance package, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, we basically started out modeling it like what ours for our employees is. It does contain components for preventative care, health screening, all of those type of things. We're looking at a fairly high deductible because they're doing that now, so they're willing to do that. The biggest thing we focus on is that preventative and the screenings and those type of things that they just don't do now. to give you all the numbers, I have some very good people back home that probably handle that better than I do. But
that's some Bradley.
Thank you, Chair. I think the concept level is what I was thinking about. But then I'm assuming, though, that this is built on a self-insured model, and is that using the multi-employer welfare association model?
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Yeah. That's exactly correct, okay. Self-insured model. And, we currently have added, because we're so well-funded now in our employee group, now we've added a $2,500 HRA component at no cost to the employees also, which has further encouraged people taking care of themselves.
I think I would add one more thing.
I think I know a lot of people that are ready to sign up for you. Can they join your plan? It sounds pretty good. I was kidding.
That's right. Representative Huntley, I think you get the last question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nielsen, what's the maximum out-of-pocket expense you have for a family of your 90 that you're currently taking care of?
$3,000.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, is the some of the preventive stuff done before you start on the deductible?
It's 100% paid for by the company.
The preventive?
Yes. And with the $2,500 HRA component, the first $2,500 is zero deductible. So what the purpose of that is to really take care of some of our young families, because everybody's starting out with young families. That's when the hill's steepest. So we've been able to fund that also.
Mr. Smith, we're glad to find something that's actually working somewhere. Representative Powell has the actual last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it'll be short. Sir, just describe a little bit of what your preventative services are. What, if you can give us a flavor of what the plan covers and what it doesn't cover.
Mr. Nielsen.
Simple things like physicals twice a year, mammograms for employees that need them, cholesterol screenings, I know the concept, the details are sometimes sketchy. But it's most of the basic stuff that anybody like I would have or you would have on a fully funded health care program would have. I think the most important thing we back it up, though, is every 2 weeks they get a newsletter. I've got an HR director who really deserves a lot of credit. She's not here, but Sherry Bruins, our human resource manager, and she could answer every one of those things endlessly. But constantly reminding them and educating them through newsletters and communication to make good choices. If they never get sick in the first place, you solve half the problem.
And that's probably, is that good enough or not? Maybe Ms. Kwan, you can help put together a response. We'd like to see just the kind of the sketch and the detail that you kind of get the flavor. We'd like to know some more. This is very.
You want to know the components of the actual plan and what it would look like.
And some details, yeah.
Yeah, that's not a problem. I should have brought that along. My apologies. I would like to just one quick comment.
You get the last word.
I get the last word. Well,
of your own, yeah.
We are also, we started this model 13 years ago, and a group of cooperatives in Minnesota got together, and we are self-insured for workers' comp also. And this past year, we formed a self-insurance group for property and casualty. I think that's the first one in the nation. So the group of us that are involved in this understand the risk of self-insurance because we've been doing it. And we think we can make this work, too. That's the salesman in me. Sorry about that.
It's a good pitch. Ms. Klum, you have another guest, too? Is it Escudal? Ms. Escudal, welcome to the committee.
That's correct.
Did I say it right?
Yes, you did. Thank you, Chairman Abler and members of the committee. First of all, like Jeff did, I want to also thank you, Chairman Abler, and Representatives Huntley and Bradley for your help last year getting the MeWeb legislation passed. It was a significant step forward and something that our membership had been asking for a long time, so we appreciate that. Just a little bit of background. I'm not Tom Ebert. He recently had 3 wisdom teeth pulled, one of which was impacted, so his ability to speak tonight would have been fine.
He's driving some health costs himself. Okay.
Yes. quickly, the Employers Association is a not-for-profit membership association. We have approximately 1,400 employers that belong to us, and we've been in business for 60 years, so we value our employer relationships very greatly. 9 years ago, we did indeed offer a health care option for our members, and at its largest point, it covered over 20,000 employees. Unfortunately, that was with Prudential, who decided to leave the state of Minnesota, and so we were forced into looking for other viable options. Liz has mentioned a few of those, including accountable provider networks. 3 years ago, we started looking at the MEWA legislation as a possible alternative to that. As an outcome of working on that, we've been working with Sheffield Olson and McQueen to partner with them to work on a high deductible healthcare plan, which is the handout that's being passed around at this point in time. And we held meetings with our members. We have been very fortunate that our members have been wonderfully supportive of this. Last fall, after we submitted the application to the Department of Commerce, we ran meetings for members and their brokers and had over 300 of our members in attendance. Now, if everybody signed up, that would represent close to 20,000 lives, and that would be a significant amount of lives covered under the plan. Just last week, I was speaking to one of our trustees, who is Cliff Anderson, the president of Crown Ironworks. And he is the typical example of an employer who is looking for a competitive option in healthcare. He has about 45 employees, and the point that he made to me last week was, please continue to work on this and get it finished, because he is competing for talent in this marketplace against large employers. And if he can't find and secure and offer a good competitive healthcare option to his employees, he won't be able to compete for that talent. And so it is a critical issue in his mind. Whereas we filed the application in September, and we understand that it is a new thing that the Department of Commerce has not seen before. We've tried, I think, both sides in good faith effort to answer questions, but there are some things that have arisen in terms of letters of credit, which do concern small employers, and also the reinsurance product, which we've worked long and hard to find a reinsurer that would bring a viable product. We think that we're close. We are responding to a request, and it's coming soon in terms of a letter by the reinsurance company, at which time we hope that we'll have final approval from the Department of Commerce to move forward. However, because we haven't had it, we've had to push a couple of dates out for our members and may need to do that again in terms of it. When I was seeking input, I spoke with the attorney for the trust, who has given wonderful advice and due diligence in this process and helped us set up the trust for the employers. And a couple of things that he brought to mind is in relationship to Section 62H, in terms of being modified to permit the use of reinsurance arrangements that actually fit into the technical requirements but require a little bit more of a broader mind regarding the traditional stop-loss product. He had about 6 points, but I'm only going to say two of them or three of them. The other one is the premium tax rate that applies to MEWAs. It should not exceed the premium tax rate that applies to HMOs. MEWAs currently will pay a 2% premium tax, whereas the HMOs will only pay a 1% tax. So he, in his guidance and advice, would look at that. He also, as he's gotten to know our members, said that it would be helpful if the legislature were to formally express its support for the use of responsibly operated MEWAs and trusts as a means of providing health benefits to employees of small employers. As I talked with the small employers, and again as I spoke with several groups today, one of which was a manufacturing alliance, they said that it is one of their key agenda items, is finding competitive, affordable options. Ours is a high deductible plan with the HRA plan design component in it, meaning that the employers will still have skin in the game in terms of funding health insurance. But what they're looking at by coming together as in a self-insured pool is, rather than risking it on their own, which means we're hearing more and more of our members, smaller members, calling into our HR hotline saying, I'm thinking about self-insuring, how do I go about doing that? They could have one bad year that could almost put them out of business in terms of doing that. The other concern that I hear on our research line are small employers who are saying, I may not be able to insure my workers anymore. And so I think we need to look at a variety of creative options, such as what the Karma Co-op is doing and what we're attempting to do here as well. So I hope it doesn't become an issue of not offering health care for small employers, that we're able to look at these creative options and continue to move them forward.
Very good. Members? Representative Huntley, what question might you be asking?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and ma'am, the innovation tool sheet?
Correct.
Is that what you're doing now, or does this require you to be a MIWA before you can do this?
It requires us to do, we're doing the MIWA before we can start the Innovation 2 program, correct.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and ma'am, the HRA part of it is the employee's going to put that money up, or does the employer put some of the money up in advance of the tax-free?
Under the current HRA model, it is a book liability on the part of the employer. So oftentimes an employer would take a look at funding up to perhaps 50% of the deductible. So if you were to look at plan option number one, where it's a $2,000, $4,000, the employer might fund a $1,000 HRA for a single premium for the employee, which means that the employee goes into that first, then they go to a $1,000 deductible, then they go into the 90-10 plan after that.
Thank you.
And maybe you can just tell us, what kind of rates does this carry? Do you know offhand, or is you still figuring that out?
Well, we did indeed have conditional approval to start doing the quoting process, and I can speak for the Employers Association in terms of our quote that we received back, and that it would allow us to stabilize our rates, and depending upon which HRA model we choose to go with in terms of funding, we could potentially also reduce the amount of money that both the employee and the employer are spending on premium dollars.
So is there a specific number you can tell me about, like what would the rate run, just a ballpark number, like $600 a month for a family, or $900, we're not going to hold you to the answer, but just roughly, is that not fair to ask?
My Somi is here and have been seeing more globally the quotes coming back than I have.
The census of the age demographics of the group, but it's going to run probably around the $600 to $700. That's funding the HRA.
$600 to $700. All right, and of course it varies depending on which option you've chosen. One is a lot less expensive, obviously. Other members have questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one. You have HRA in here. Was there a particular reason why HRA was chosen rather than HSA as the option?
Is that all?
Well, we would like to eventually offer the option of an HSA. Right now, what our members have told us is that under the HRA, if HSA became more similar in structure to the HRA in terms of employers being able to make a choice of what they don't have to fund, such as RX copays and co-pays for prescription glasses, those types of things which they currently don't pay for, then it might become a more financially viable model. But we're looking at that as well. We'd like to see some changes in the HSA legislation.
I think, Mr. Chair, there are times the HRA does allow, sometimes employers can be a little more creative because there's a little more employer control in it. I know the clinic in Rochester, Home State Medical Center, went to the HRA. Mm-hmm. Employees like it, the employers like it, and it does allow a little more sort of control of it. Mm-hmm. Looks either way. Thank you.
And I have other representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about members and ownership, can you explain that a little bit more? Who has ownership and?
Correct.
Ms. Escudo.
We've created a separate trust aside from the Employers Association. It will be comprised of members who are in the health care plan. Right now it has three trustees because we're not completely up and running. Members who actually participated in our previous healthcare product that we had, they will.
And can I just interrupt?
Yeah, Representative Houston.
Members being
employers.
Employer. Okay. Thank you.
Two separate. For example, Rise Incorporated and Crown Holdings are members right now.
All right. Thank you. That's
okay.
Clarified for me.
I just have one question. Maybe a reinsurance 101. Let's say you reinsure for $50,000. Who convinces the reinsurance group that you actually paid the $50,000? Do you submit a bunch of bills to them and itemize that equals $50,000, and then they say, okay, then we're going to kick in our part? And when they have if you buy a reinsurance plan, what's the set of benefits they cover? And do they have we talk about mandates and coverages and so on, and just
there's no trickery. I just want to figure out the answer to this question. So how do they decide what's a covered expense? Because you may not cover some expenses in a normal insurance product that you want to get, eyeglasses or some other alternative services. How do they work that on reinsurance? Is that a fair question? Maybe Ms. Kwan.
Mr.
Do you want to phone a friend?
I'm going to give you a candid answer. We've been working with, trying to work with reinsurers for about 5 or 6 years, and what I've come to understand is we have to show them a scenario or a package that we put together that basically doesn't give them much risk for it. So what you do is you work with the reinsurer and say, okay, this is the package, like the innovation tool. This is the package that we want to offer. And some reinsurers might be interested in it. It took us a while to find one for the Employers Association that was willing to do something innovative on how they structured the stop-loss coverage, where they set the attachment point for both the specific and aggregate coverage.
Let me be more specific. But you might find yourself spending more than $50,000 to get into the stop loss if you cover 10,000 of other kinds of costs. I mean, an example of what our mandates is Port Weinstein's. Mm-hmm. Let's say that they don't, you know, and that's a mandate in Minnesota stuff, but if you have a ERISA plan, it may not be covered unless they wanted to cover that. Would you have to decide if that's in their package of covered benefits?
Mr. Chair, as detailed as any other health product is, you get down to what's covered and when it's covered and how long it's covered.
And so, just as a caveat, I've been kind of putting this in my head, some of these reinsurance products, we talked about pooling and so on, and so the devil is in the details, and even though we talk about mandates on the state level, relative to some of our good friends and HMOs, for instance, and other places, that the benefit set that's allowed in a reinsurance product is just as important in the solvency of your product and making sure it goes right. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes, but may I add one other thing?
Please.
What gave us fits last year that we didn't know how to address is for reinsurers, it might not be so much the cost of one mandate. It's that they have to write a way different policy than they do every place else in the country. So it's more we're not that important. Minnesota or the Employers Association is not that important to a multinational reinsurer, and for the local broker that we work with to have to go back because we have this little change and this little change based on state law, they just don't even want to pay attention to us. So if we can find a way to do something good for our citizens and keep them covered, but do it also so that we comply with ERISA rather than state requirements, it makes it so much easier to attract a good, goodly priced product in the reinsurance market.
And I appreciate that. So, and this is, you're getting it where I was hoping to go just in terms of understanding this. And so if you, let's just say Port Weinstein, which is a commonly mentioned mandate of ours, that I didn't help pass, by the way, so there's no skin in this one. And so if you, as one of these groups, decided to cover that, even though it wasn't part of the stock, ERISA, the reinsurance product that you just bought that was an off-the-shelf one, that would come out of the HRA money or something, but wouldn't go against toward the reinsurance threshold then. That's probably correct, I think. Because that wouldn't be a covered expense under what they would call their mandate set, right? Their benefit set.
Mr. Chair, probably would be as it's negotiated with the stop-loss carrier, but in general what the stop-loss carrier wants to do is see a product that matches what federal requirements are for coverage.
Yeah, so I'm just getting the point. You could spend $60,000.
Mr. Chair, could we have somebody that knows something?
Yeah, maybe. Welcome to the voice in the audience is now embodied in our committee.
Hi, I'm Cindy Sheffield from Sheffield Olson McQueen. The question about an employer being able to make a decision as to what they would cover under the HRA component if we're not covered under the stop loss is true, an employer could definitely determine whether they want it to do something, because the HRA component is their own self-insured component under the high deductible plan. I will tell you this, though, that the self-insured product that this Employers Association has put together is following almost all of the state mandates. There are very few, if any, that are going to be excluded, because that's the kind of coverage that these employers have now. So they're not looking to not cover things that are covered currently, if at all possible.
And, Ms. Sheffield, it wasn't a trap so much. I just was trying to help people understand that the question of mandates never quite goes away, even when you get high up in the reinsurance world, that people may like or may not like their ability to get something, and it's either covered as... There's no free lunch. You either pay for it in the reinsurance product, or you pay for it out of cash out of the HRA or HSA part of it. Is that fair?
Well, no. But the state, because these are ERISA plans, it would not be covered under, if it's not going to be covered under the plan, the employer determines that that's not a covered expense, then it would not be covered.
Oh, and so they would only cover in the HRA part. What the reinsurance would be covering?
It's typically going to follow the same benefits as the high deductible self-insured plan.
Okay.
An employer can determine to do otherwise, but most of them mirror the same coverage.
Okay. Representative Huntley, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, either one, back to plan option one. If the employer puts $1,000 into the HRA and... somebody has a $2,000 medical bill. Mm-hmm. The first $1,000 would be paid out of the HRA, presumably. And then the second $1,000 would go against that deductible, or is it, you've got a $2,000 deductible there, and mm-hmm. does that include or exclude the HRA money?
Ms. Sheffield?
That's correct.
It includes it.
Okay. So the maximum on the deductible part, they would be out of their personal pocket, is $1,000 in that case.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
The other option is that if they don't spend all that $1,000 in a plan year,
that
the employer can elect to roll it over, which truly is one of the benefits of the HRA plan design.
And Ms. Escudal, but they don't have to roll it over if they don't want to, right?
The employer does not have to elect to roll it over.
Because they control that compared to HSA, which rolls over, and that's part of the... It depends how costs go. If you're up, then you keep it, and or if you're down, whatever, if your expenses are higher, then you might.
It's determined at the beginning of the plan year, not the end.
Oh, really? Not based upon product, not performance. Representative Huntley.
Just for information, the HSAs, the money in that pot belongs to the employee, and if he changes jobs, he takes it with him. Mm-hmm. And if the HRAs, that's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Escudal. Well, this is productive. I think you get the last question, Representative Bradley.
Well, just add a little bit. Employers do get pretty creative. In the case of Olmsted Medical Center, at the end of the year, half goes back to the employee. It was part of their way, they believe, to provide a better incentive. So it was kind of an interesting approach, because they wouldn't have to do that. But that shows the flexibility.
Yeah. Well, this has been very productive. I want to thank you, all four of you, for coming to this part of the presentation. Ms. Quam, I appreciate it. And we're just, you can come up. And so I appreciate this. I want to give you the commercial part of our meeting now. The handout section. You have all the little handouts there. This is not part of today's talk. I didn't realize we were going to be doing it today. This is the how to, if you're a MedMal promoter, how to keep the issue alive. It's all right here. If you're trying to promote that, that was just meant to be a little tongue-in-cheek. I didn't know it was today's. I didn't kind of plan it to be today. The next couple, I think, came from some drug lobbyist friends of mine. The next four, I think, is that right? Ironically, some of the efforts to cost contain don't. And these four articles talk about that. And sometimes if you try to save money, you spend more. So that's just interesting. So beware what you think you're buying. GMACC. Well, this fellow couldn't come, this GMHCC, and he wanted us to get his testimony, and so I suggest we read that over. And this came from the Universal Health folks, this next one talking about administrative costs from some of the HMOs that could be kind of provocative for a guest in the audience. Just try to keep you always on your toes. The next one has to do with irrigal choice. Oh, this is just some state, some national news. It happens to mention Minnesota as being noted for its smart buy alliance. The next one has to do with Sam's. This is today's paper. They're doing a discount card with United Health. Some of those discount cards are just where they go squeeze some savings out of a provider. Do you want to be on this card or not? And then they charge you $9 a month. The next one, early hurdle for a drug, and it got kind of small as you shrink it down. It was the last part of that sentence that I circled. It says it has the right to market the medicines as it sees fit. Just interesting little thought there. The drug companies are here. We always want to keep them on their toes. We think of altruism and great discoveries, but they can market however they want, even though some say they should not combine it. They're combining it because they want to. That's a marketing move, which is interesting. This next one has to do with the... we heard from Kenny. Mr. Kenny was here. Sean, was it? With this... This union, they had a very good presentation that they made the paper, which is kind of nice. They have an article from Mayo how they're noticing some cost issues and worried about even making ends meet down there. So obviously marketing alone won't help out. The next one's about radiation oncology. I thought, what better place to bring up the topic than just this place, just to mention the term. And I thought you'd get a kick out of that, just that it's there. And actually the point of the issue is article is that not everything that's new works better. And there's a whole long version of this, which I can get to, but I didn't think you wanted to know more than just about that. But the study was, if you do different, some innovative ways, been working better than the old ways, they didn't mention any costs. And the other side of this article you might find interesting about airline drinking water. Apparently, I wouldn't drink airline water. It says 17.2% of airline water tested just recently. This is just really hot off the presses. That's coliform bacteria. So I'm not sure that's what you want to do. You know, fresh your breath or something. The next two articles are kind of related. Wisconsin has a hospital, has an information hotline website thing about hospitals, which I thought was kind of interesting. And just as if the timing couldn't be better, on Channel 4 they had a kind of a little I-team something or other where they compared some prices. And just to disclose, this is not a scientific study. It's just they called up and asked them some prices. It'd be fun to have them call them a different day and ask them the prices and see how the answers were, but there's quite a variation. And I don't know, this is non-scientific, it's just interesting. And I think as they're trying to find where the costs are and where the benefits are, we have to consider all these. Next is an email from a person who wanted to rip on insurance companies as the reason for all the problems. So that was kind of just refreshing for people just to have a chance to vent. So I thought you might get a kick out of that. This next one has to do with... this is a handout, the drug-related morbidity and mortality, is that medication management that we heard last time. And the last one... Oh, this is from Liz Quam about today's presentation. So trying to provide eclectic reading for your weekend needs, equal opportunity for all to express their thoughts. And I do want to welcome now the regional service agencies. And Mr. Szczesinski, want to introduce yourself and your guest? And we've got, we have till about 10 or 12 after. So if you want to make your presentation, the timing's, we got more involved than we thought we would, but I think it's probably up the same alley you're in. So. It's a good day, so welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Szczesinski, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Service Agencies, formerly known as the Service Cooperatives. You've heard a lot about us the past few years. And with me today is Mr. Paul Brinkman, who's going to share with you some innovative ideas and things we're doing and would like to do. I think it'll be a strategic healthcare initiative that will save some dollars. Paul is the Executive Director of the Northeast Service Cooperatives. He'll speak on behalf of all.
Welcome, Mr. Brinkman.
Thank you, Chairman Abler, members of the committee. My name is Paul Brinkman. I work in Mountain Iron, live in Virginia. Established in Minnesota Statute 123A21, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives provide a variety of services to schools, cities, counties, and other governmental agencies, including academic challenges, cooperative purchasing, information technology, special education training, and healthcare insurance. That's our focus today. Last session, we spent a lot of time with you and your colleagues here in St. Paul. The teachers' union have a proposal for a statewide health insurance plan, and we were asked to come down and talk about what we do. At the end of the session, we received a lot of feedback from you and your colleagues, from our own members, and even from a couple of board members on my board of directors. They said, you know, we like a lot of things you're doing, but there's one thing you can do better. Would you sit down with the teachers' union and talk about if there's some common ground? Good question. So, during the summer, we sounded out Larry Wicks, the executive director of Education Minnesota, and to his credit, he said, why don't we sit down together? We met first in St. Paul in August. He said, as long as we can keep several tracks going at once, we'd be happy to sit down and look at common ground together. We went back to the drawing board and talked among our colleagues and figured, if we're going to sit down, let's do something substantial. Let's explore real options. Let's look at things that we can actually do together rather than just chit-chat. And that's the document you have in front of you today, dated March 4th. I have an updated version dated March 8th, which we can make available to Chairman Abler and the committee. Before we begin, I want to make one qualifier with three components. We're very serious about these options, these initiatives, because we know they work. We're going to talk about why in a moment. But when we explore these options, ideally we'd love to have them part of an initiative that is a public policy initiative among education employers to include Education Minnesota, their union colleagues, and other state education associations. Whether or not that happens, time will tell. Whether or not that happens, we also invite anyone who would like to use these 20 initiatives for their own purposes. I spoke at a conference last Friday in Plymouth. I said, if you can use these, by all means, share them with your people. That's the benefit of working as a public employer, isn't it? You can share your material with others for the greater good. And then finally, again, whatever substantial might happen as we look for common ground with our state education colleagues, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives will be using these 20 initiatives for our own strategies and priorities in the years ahead. Let's walk through the proposal. Again, we're talking about 20 strategic activities. And to begin, let's give you some background. Again, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives currently serve over 600 schools, cities, counties, and other governmental agencies, representing over 60,000 employees and nearly 130,000 covered lives. Our annual pool premiums for fiscal year 05 are estimated at about $475 million. The Minnesota Service Cooperatives are moving forward with other educational organizations on 20 specific strategic health care initiatives that we find in this report here today. Some of the recent accomplishments that we've made together with our members, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives continue to focus on improving the health and choices for all pool members, employees, and their families. A couple of the recent accomplishments include approximately 25% of our pool members have adopted consumer-directed health plans that feature, among other things, first dollar coverage for preventive care, cancer screenings, prenatal care, and immunizations for children under age 5. We have currently 6,000 employees have health savings accounts with an average balance estimated over $1,000. We also have a new health care coaching program, disease management for employees and family members with chronic disease. Over 20,000 employees and family members with diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses have begun to more actively manage their health care. In fact, it can be done. Let's show some of the recent data available on Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota's website for service cooperative participants. You see some of the key chronic diseases, including diabetes, heart disease, chronic pulmonary disease, asthma, end-stage renal disease, and extended conditions, and some of the impact that we're making in dealing with that 20% of any pooled health plan that drives about 80% of the costs. These are real numbers in the current fiscal year. We also want to note that a recent study of the quality of health care in the United States published in the New England Journal of Medicine found participants received 55% of recommended care. There is a shortage of quality care, an alarming statistic, one that this committee is all aware of from the mainstream media. The study concluded by stating the deficits we have identified to recommended processes for basic care pose serious threats to the health of the American public. Strategies to reduce these deficits in care are warranted and timely. In fact, 30% of all direct health care outlays today are a result of poor quality that has been reported in at least one recent publication. Poor quality care costs a typical employer between $1,900 and $2,250 per covered employee per year, according to one recent report. Finally, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives have volunteered to join the Smart Buy Alliance and stand ready to engage and participate in helping transform the healthcare system. Some concrete transformations include, number one, creating an electronic medical record for all patients. Number two, reducing the time it takes for medical improvement to move into physician practice. Number three, improve the provider and health plan connectivity and transfer of healthcare data. And number four, employers may begin to promote the environment in which employees and family members become more involved in managing their health care, a theme, Chairman Abler and members of the committee, that we've heard already this afternoon. Over the past few years, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives have created the following 20 health care initiatives for member school districts and local units of government. Other independent groups have reached similar conclusions, including the Minnesota Task Force on Health Care Reform, chaired by Senator David Durenberger, and a recent article published in the Harvard Business Review entitled Redefining Health Competition in Healthcare. I believe that article is available for you here today. Any questions before we walk through the 20 initiatives?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Number one, form an alliance for healthcare reform. We're going to work together. Let's come to the table together. Speaking with one voice through the alliance, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives, their pool members, and other education associations can move towards healthcare reform through new consumer education initiatives, recommended model arrangements, and collaborative negotiating. We talked about how that process might be able to be set up. Number two, join the LeapFrog Group. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform could consider joining the LeapFrog Group. LeapFrog is a national healthcare watchdog group, and they've identified four strategies for improving quality of healthcare, including influence on healthcare plans, creating incentives and rewards, educating consumers, and transparencies. Initiative number three, develop new consumer education healthcare initiatives. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform, employees and family members need to be educated in a planned and systemic way so to make their personal decisions about healthcare for their best needs. Characteristics of the proposed new model include consumers encouraged to evaluate healthcare provider quality and costs, consumers empowered to make informed healthcare decisions. Local, regional, and national quality care standards are recognized and adopted by providers, and healthcare providers are paid for quality performance. Initiative number four, recommend uniform healthcare reporting. This one has been discussed a number of years, really in Minnesota, maybe one of the few areas where we really lack in healthcare reform in this particular state. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform may consider recommending uniform healthcare reporting. The uniform healthcare reporting may include uniform reporting standards, statistical analysis, and comparative data, as well as reports to pool members, including claims tracking reports and others of interest to our members, and reports to individual employees, that consumer-directed model, the buzzword, which really makes sense when you analyze how it can help each of us make better health care decisions. Initiative number five, recommend disease management strategies. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform may consider identifying existing care support disease management programs, review and analyze current care support disease management programs, and recommend exemplary care support disease management programs that might be available to our members. Initiative number six, recommend model group health plan designs. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform may consider creating model recommendations for preventive care. They consider creating model recommendations for preventive care, pharmacy benefits, and network arrangements, and also create model recommendations for primary care, deductibles, copayments, coinsurance, maximum out-of-pocket limits, and lifetime limits. Recommendation number five, create a model group health plan rules, including eligibility guidelines, collective bargaining language, and employer contribution recommendations. We could consider creating model eligibility participation guidelines for group health plans, creating model collective bargaining language, and creating model employer contribution guidelines, eliminating practices like cash in lieu or continued low levels of employer contribution toward family coverage. Number eight, recommend school districts consider the standing offer to re-underwrite and re-rate any Minnesota Service Cooperative Pool member. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform could recommend all public employers model health plan rules, consider requesting new group health plans premium proposals. The Minnesota Service Cooperatives have issued a standing offer to any pool member for re-underwriting and re-rating. Initiative number 9, recommend model consumer-directed health plans. Some of them discussed already this afternoon. The Alliance could consider recommending model consumer health care plans. Right now, approximately, as we mentioned earlier, 25% of our pool members offer a consumer-directed health plan attached to a savings account. In fact, features of the consumer-directed plan include much of what we've talked about here today, coverage for preventive care, maximum out-of-pocket limits, and coordination with other health plans. Number 10, recommend model consumer-directed health savings accounts. The Alliance should commit itself to offering a choice of consumer-directed health plans and savings accounts in an attempt to deal with cost containment and rising premiums over time. Some of the three models we've talked about already today include health reimbursement accounts, in general an employer-covered risk arrangement. Number 2, a health savings accounts, which are oftentimes savings accounts set aside to cover risk on behalf of individuals, and voluntary employee beneficiary association trusts, known as VEBAs, which again are employer-funded and IRS-approved. Number 11, recommend model flexible spending account arrangements. The Alliance could consider recommending model flexible spending account arrangements. Taking tax advantages of using the flexible spending accounts should be communicated to all participants and potential participants. It's been estimated that less than 40% of school employees currently use flex plans to pay for their out-of-pocket medical expenses. That hits on that consumer education piece too, doesn't it, Mr. Chairman? Implement a health care expense coordination plan. Healthcare expense coordination plan could include medical expenses for individuals that are often paid by multiple carriers, so you could coordinate among your long-term disability policies, workers' compensation, automobile policies, and general liability policies. Recommendation number 13, promote the creation of new reinsurance arrangements sponsored by the state of Minnesota.
We were letting you go, but I just kind of peeked up when I read about your collaboration thing there. Do you have a proposal on number 12 about how you would coordinate some of those coverages like work comp and auto?
Not at this point, Mr. Chairman.
That's just the kind of raw idea that you're...
Correct.
Right. And I actually just want to clarify one thing. When we say Alliance, is that the Smart Buy Alliance? Is that the alliance of all your co-ops?
No, that is the state alliance, I believe, put on the table by the administration.
And that's the alliance ideas with your flavor, with your twist on them.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you. You're doing great. Go on, please.
Item number 13, promote the creation of new reinsurance arrangements sponsored by the state of Minnesota. The Alliance could consider promoting the creation of health plan reinsurance arrangements sponsored by the state, similar to the reinsurance arrangement for workers' compensation. Managing the cost of high cases can prove difficult, and many groups have experienced large premium increases resulting from one or two large claims. A new state arrangement under reinsurance could provide a better alternative. Number 14, develop model employee assistance programs that could include evaluating current EAP models, incorporating EAPs into disease management programs, really where it's at, including EAP arrangements into health claim systems, analyzing and incorporating mental health and depression services into these programs, evaluating current health plan coverage for mental health and depression services, and recommending coordination of health plans, disease management programs, and the EAP arrangement. Number 15, recommend model approaches in managing drug refunds. The Minnesota Service Cooperative Pools have used drug refunds primarily to build incurred but not reported reserves, rate stabilization reserves, and or fund wellness programs as directed by insurance advisory committees and boards of directors. Health plans and other self-funded groups would benefit from identification of recommended model drug refund management strategies.
Let me just interrupt you there. Do you use PBMs as part of that? Or in your co-ops, do you use PBMs, or how do you manage your pharmacy?
We do use aggressive managed care for pharmacy benefits, yes.
With your own personal version of a PBM?
No, we use one through Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. You can keep going.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm nursing a terrible case of laryngitis, and my apologies.
Not helping, are we?
Number 16. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform may consider developing new wellness strategies. including analyzing current coverage for preventive wellness care services, identifying model national wellness programs and practices, and recommending model wellness programs and practices to member school districts. Initiative number 17, create a new uniform annual employee benefit summary. Pool members could adopt a uniform annual employee benefit summary for each employee, including employer and employee contributions to group health plans, group life plans, group short and long-term disability, group dental arrangements. You get the picture, again, coordinating these efforts so that the consumer fully aware what he or she has for coverage. Number 18, create a buyer's guide and model long-term care policies. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform could consider such an initiative. Current long-term policies should be reviewed and analyzed. Many employers and employees are considering this insurance coverage as lifespans increase and this need becomes more necessary. Can we afford it? I don't know. But again, it's something we could discuss and incorporate into a model program on a statewide basis. Number 19, post-retirement healthcare savings accounts. The Alliance for Healthcare Reform could consider such accounts. A report on the tax advantages and benefits of post-retirement health savings accounts should be provided to all Minnesota Service Cooperative Pool members and their employees. And finally, number 20, recommend new model retiree group health plans. Recommend model coordination and continuation of retiree health plans, medical savings accounts, and Medicare supplement plans. Create ancillary discount programs for retirees, including discount programs for pharmacy and durable medical goods, discounted optical and dental plans, and related services. As mentioned at the beginning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have currently placed this in front of Education Minnesota. To their credit, they have organized a tentative meeting date at the end of March, where we plan to meet with them and other union representatives. Concurrent with that activity, we're also discussing this particular initiative with the Minnesota School Boards Association and the Association of School Administrators, including Charlie Kite and Bob Meeks. And one final anecdote, if I may. Even though it doesn't incorporate all of these pieces, you were looking for specific examples. My employer, the Northeast Service Cooperative, went under a VEBA arrangement 2 years ago. We were able to do an apples-to-apples comparison of where we would have been under a traditional plan the past 2 years versus where we are now under the VEBA plan. In year one, apples-to-apples, the Northeast Service Cooperative, as an employer, invested $17,000 over trend to move into the VEBA arrangement. In year two, off trend, we're containing $26,000 in costs. So we have already improved the trend line under a two-year time frame. When we went to the board to make the proposal and we went to our employees to make a proposal, we offered a three-year trend. We thought we could get our arms around this in 3 years. It's happened in two. And again, it's some of the same components we talked about today with your other guests and some of the things that are threaded within this particular model. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. I got a couple of questions I think other members do. And I appreciate how you're trying to blend this in, kind of blend your work with the Alliance business. Just a couple of thoughts. In your as you do your work, now, do you blend in your, you have your work and you layer it on top of a Blue Cross or other kind of plan generally?
Yes.
Is that how it goes?
Yes.
And so the admin that you would experience would be partly blended with theirs and partly your own costs, right?
Well, currently the service cooperatives have capped their administration fees at $985 per contract per month. That's been capped for 2 years now.
And what percent would that be?
It works out to about 1.5%. But the percentage varies from region to region because, quite frankly, you have slightly more benefit-rich plans in northeast Minnesota compared to more modest benefit plans in southwest Minnesota. So that percentage may change, but we've actually capped the administrative fee at a flat amount the last 2 years. One of the reasons we did that, quite frankly, is coming into this, I've been on the job 5 years. About year two, we realized we were profiting off the pain of our members. Not a good arrangement. So we thought if we went to a cap model, it was a lot easier to communicate and quite frankly fit their needs as members, because we've got to wear one of their shoes.
Some of us kind of wish other people might think the same way you think about profiting off.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that the Chairman know what we do for that service, that is what we administer.
So what do you do for that kind of money anyway?
Well, one thing that we do that And Bill, in a moment, why don't you run down that list? Because I knew you captured this list last session. But one thing we do that I don't think gets a lot of attention, we're not in the insurance business. And I won't run from being in the insurance business because by default we provide insurance services. We're happy to do so. It's enjoyable work. We're in the member business. And in a member-driven environment, in a business-to-business model, and that's what we are, business-to-business government, quite frankly, we can provide things to members, expertise, time, analysis, coordination, that they don't quite know where to turn. They don't have it in-house. And they feel like a small fish in a big pond when it comes to the carrier side of things. So today, for example, we had all but four of our 32 superintendents meeting in Proctor at Blackwoods Cafe with representatives of Blue Cross Blue Shield, an attorney from the Twin Cities, and representatives from our staff talking about the upcoming renewal. What can we expect? What kind of pooling models can we use when we get our renewal rates? How can we get, in fact, we had them adopt these 20 initiatives. How can we reach out even better to members for best practices? So I use anecdote as one piece. Another thing that we're doing currently, we're working with school districts and city counties all the time. I'll give you one example. MNA was here today. It's kind of interesting because I'm meeting with the HR director of Virginia Regional Medical Center, which is a public hospital, to talk about how we can put a post-retirement savings account in place, the severance money already encumbered, that fits the needs of the Minnesota Nurses Association at that union local.
I have a question for you, and then I think Representative Huntley has a question. Oh, you don't? Okay. What's your trend across the state? Trend-wise, what are you noticing in terms of the increase? What's it in your premium increases?
Our premium increases are running, last year they ran around 7 to 10% statewide. Our region was at the high end, near 10%. We have been running under trend and running under the rate increases of the public employee insurance plan for much of the last 5 years. This year, when members call us and say, what do I budget? I'm telling them to budget at 15 to 20% because part of the reason the pools have been successful for the service cooperatives is we do underwrite very carefully. And the experience, as you follow the tracking reports for some of our members, is still high. And then they have to anticipate a larger renewal, which we will moderate under our agreement with Blue Cross and under our pooling dollars, but it still would be in the double-digit range. But in the aggregate, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're running below trend, and last year was 7 to 10%.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said that your administration is capped at 1-point-something percent. How does that compare with other, whether it's our state public employee plan in terms of cost of administration or whether it's other private plans that are out there? Can you tell me where that fits within the continuum of administration?
Mr. Brinkman. Mr. Susan.
If Bill could help with that, please. Because he had the real number. Well, we're under.
Tell us the real number.
Chairman, it's interesting. The legislative auditor last year took a look at the service cooperative model and it was studied. Studied the state of Minnesota paid for it, the Fred and Anders report 2 years ago. We are about 2% less than state employee insurance, which puts us with the insurance you have. Our administrative fees are about 2% less than what you have. They run about 8%. I think ours on average was about 6% overall for our portion of that administrative cost. And with respect to fees, the public insurance employers, which we have at Willow River, it's not service properties, but chief insurance, risk managed by the Department of Employee Relations, they're at about 9%. So we're in prison. Yeah. Our administrative costs are less than anybody else in the public market sector. Very pleased.
But if I may add, administrative costs are, Mr. Chairman,
we're almost out of time, so just summarize.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to say that administrative costs are not off the table for us here.
Fair enough. And Representative Broad and then Representative Ocampo. Go ahead, Representative Broad.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Ocampo.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question always to the service cooperatives, because we have some in our area, and as you know, several of them have opted out and aren't offering insurance at all to their schools. In fact, I think we have three more that are looking at doing that. And the problem is there's a pool, but the pool is just in that school district. And so my question is, and therefore, if there's a catastrophic, like in the school that I taught in, one of the teacher's daughters needed a kidney transplant, and because it was a small pool, maybe 100 employees, whatever, the insurance premiums got so high that literally there's no health insurance in that school. And so my question is I've always thought for a long time, is there a way to take all of these school districts and make that pool larger? Because the problem we're having in our area is we have all these small schools, and there's one cancer or one, and then it's not cost effective anymore, so they drop out of your pool too. So if every little school or a lot of little schools are dropping out because they are high insurance risks, that also makes your pool safer because they've lost their insurance. And I've gone kind of round and round with my service cooperatives about that, and is there a way that we can put all of the schools in a real pool instead of an individual school pool, because it certainly isn't working in my area because of all the small schools and then the one catastrophic where it prices them out, and then I'm scrounging around looking for them and helping them apply to MSHA. And
either one of you, we're almost out of time, so go ahead and answer the question.
Madam Representative, Mr. Chairman, I can only speak from experience in the Northeast. We have not lost pool members for that reason. We reinsure for that, those kind of high cases, and we've been able to handle that well in our pool. So in our case, in our regional pool, it works when it comes to dealing with high case losses.
Mr. Sosinski, you want to talk about not offering insurance and pools?
Mr. Chairman, I want to emphasize that I'm familiar with the situation that Mr. Kern is talking about. That's locally negotiated issues between union and school board, and they negotiated that case for some cash in lieu of insurance, which was an option for employees. So you end up having 100, you might have 100 people eligible for a pool, but only 22 or 15 or 17 are in that pool because the rest are taking the cash. Therefore, you've got adverse selection going on. That case was a very high case. It had very few numbers of people. So it wasn't a large, it's not a mandatory pool. There's no proposals on the table for a mandatory pool. Cash in lieu is still a real component that causes adverse selection. So that's something that I can talk a little bit more
about. Well, yeah, and I can talk about that cash in lieu, Mr. Chair. They do offer cash, but let me tell you, it doesn't cover their insurance. And unless you have a spouse who has, I don't live in that community, I taught in that community, and there is another community down the road that's doing the same thing, and there are three other communities that are, it's on the table to not offer health insurance. So,
that's no jumbo. What you described is precisely the charge of this division.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can't get
our own... So it's a service cooperative, but in some ways that's not working either, because when you do have something, and the education dollars have been cut, and how do you offer insurance? And so it negotiates out because of the high, you know what I'm talking about. So
yeah.
It's been very frustrating for those of us in our area. And then we end up on MSHA, or we used to use Minnesota Care, but that doesn't work anymore. So,
well, your point's well taken. Let me just stop for 30 seconds, and then we're out of here. This is about the end of our major testifying events. Next week, we're going to hear from the mental health discussion group with some thoughts they have, and 10, 20 minutes or whatever you want to take to make your point clear and educate us. If we can discuss it, if you need more time, let us know what you need for time to present your ideas, the two of you. We're also going to start to hear some bills that have been around that may have been to the committee or maybe not in terms of the health committee. Ideas that I think we want to hear. That list isn't known just yet, but we'll be starting to move into some language and ideas, and I think we'll be having more discussion, and I hope that we can gel around some consensus points as we begin to move into the operational part of our division. So, with that, thank you for your good attendance, and we're adjourned.